thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 79. Recorded on the 16th of December, 2011. The 2011 Campies. And it's our favorite time of year on the Digital Campus podcast, time for our year-end review and predictions for the next year, 2012. It is the usual crew with their crystal balls in front of them and their tuxes and lovely dresses on. Amanda French is here. Amanda, hi.
Hi, Dan. I went with the LBD this year, otherwise known as the little black dress.
Very nice. You look lovely today. Welcome to the Year in Review podcast. Tom Scheinfeld, are you there?
I am. I'm in my glass slippers and ball gown.
You look lovely on the red carpet. Thanks for joining us in the Year in Review. And also Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey guys, how's it going? I couldn't find my tuxedo, so I went with this leisure suit that I had from the 1970s.
Yes, well, you do look lovely too.
That shade of powder blue really suits you, Mills.
You know, I had two, so it was the powder blue or the powder green. I went with the powder blue.
You know, I do have to say that I think Joan and Melissa Rivers did say something bad about you on the red carpet podcast before us, but we won't rewind and mention what they said. So it is that time of year where we go back over 2012 and look forward to, 2011 and look forward to 2012, getting ahead of myself. So we're going to go around the horn today and talk about the cheers, jeers, and predictions. And also for the first time on the podcast, we are going to look at last year's predictions or things that we said we'd be watching to see how they turned out. That's later in the podcast, but why don't we kick it right off with Tom's hit of the year? What's your cheer this year for 2011?
Well, I want to toast the Modern Language Association for their establishment of the Division of Scholarly Communication, and more importantly, or just as importantly, I think, the appointment of Kathleen Fitzpatrick to lead that division, which I think really signals a tremendous commitment by the MLA to new and innovative forms of scholarly communication, digital technology and digital humanities. Coming from one of the most important institutions in the humanities, institutions are slow to change, and I think that MLA is an institution with a lot of vested interests, and for them to make that kind of statement is really something. And I think it signals to the rest of the field the importance of all of the things that we talk about on this podcast. So cheers to MLA.
Yeah, incredible pickup to hire Kathleen. And I know it's not the prediction round yet, but is this something that you can see happening at other organizations, scholarly societies?
I do. I think it takes some fairly bold leadership, and I think that MLA has that. I think there are I'm not going to name names, but there are some other organizations that have been making some similar moves and in their leadership that, and I expect good things from them. So I do think we're going to start to see more of this, and MLA making that first step will make a big difference to other organizations considering similar changes.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Amanda, why don't we move over to you for your hit of the year?
My hit of the year is not humanities-oriented, but more broad than that. My hit of the year is the White House's request for information on public access to peer-reviewed scholarly publications and digital data produced by scientific research. they announced this request for information in November, and the deadline for responding to it is January 2nd. And I went and looked into it and realized that it wasn't just yay or nay. You really have to give them some specific advice about how to, for instance, mitigate the assumed loss for commercial publishers and that kind of thing. But I think that this has been a really good year for open access in general. After the Berlin 9 conference, you had universities such as Princeton and Wesleyan signing pledges to commit to open access as much as they're able to. And I think that if the White House is recognizing this as an issue, that only bodes well for the future.
Yeah, we didn't really talk much about this request from the White House, and I suppose one outcome, especially given what's going on in Congress right now with SOPA and Protect IP and very kind of anti-sharing provisions in the law, that whole movement in the from the White House could go south. But certainly, it does seem that this year. We talked about the Berlin 9 conference, I believe, on the last podcast, and it had more of a, I guess, a valedictory nature to it or feel to it than other, prior conferences on open access. So it certainly seems like it's come of age. Well, thanks, Amanda, for your cheer of 2011. Mills, let's move over to you.
Well, mine's a little on the different side. Mine has to do with the something that's been promised for a while, and we haven't seen it until this year. I think there have been sort of hints that it could happen, and I think this is the time it finally happened, and that is the kind of the full disaggregation of news broadcasting as a result of the wide dissemination of smartphones, and where we saw that is in the Arab Spring, that of course continues today. I mean, the level of accountability that individuals holding up a phone and filming a massacre, a protest, a shooting, a trial, whatever, is really changing the dynamic in there. You know, I remember there was something that happened in Moldova several years ago that got heralded as the Twitter revolution, and then they found out there were hardly any Twitter accounts in Moldova, so it couldn't have been the Twitter revolution. But and plus, since it was Moldova, the whole thing was staged by the secret police in the first place. But this is a real thing, and it matters to the people on the ground, but it's also something that's going to matter to us in the digital humanities, and that is, what are we going to do with all of that content? And it's, it's something we've wrestled with at the Center for History and New Media for a long time, but we're not, as a group of people, a community of scholars, we're not really, don't have our hands around this yet. But for me, it's an incredibly positive development, and because it's impossible to deny what was happening because there were so many people shooting video and uploading it rapidly to the internet. So that's my cheer for the year.
Yeah, this is a much debated question about the importance of social media in the Arab Spring. And I think you've probably put your finger on certainly what had the most impact, which was mobile phones with cameras and video. There's something incredibly compelling about that. I was talking to Tom last night about this book I'm reading from Daniel Kahneman, The Thinking Fast and Slow, definitely one of the best books of the year. And he has this principle called what you see is all there is, that human beings, when they think about something like a revolution, unless they're actually presented with kind of visual evidence, it's sort of hard for our lizard brains to wrap around it. You could hear about an account of an uprising in the newspaper, but it doesn't have as much impact as what you see is all there is, this principle. And certainly this is a year where we saw much more from the inside and on the ground than we would have in past years because of these devices that more and more people are carrying.
Yep, and we're going to have to figure out what to do. As scholars, we're going to have to figure out what to do about that, and we don't know yet.
Right, and to archive that material for the first
time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, my hit of the year, my cheer goes to ebooks. I think this is really the year 2011 that we'll look back and say, those lines crossed, that print really declined substantially, that ebooks came of age. Amazon, in fact, just this week released a press release that said that they're selling 1 million Kindles a week now. They didn't break it out completely which Kindles they're selling, but It's a lot of e-readers, and of course the iPad sold 25 or 30 million copies this year, and it was certainly the year that I felt like I moved almost all of my reading into some kind of digital form. Within academia, beyond the publishers, or excuse me, distributors like Amazon, which by the end of the year were selling more ebooks than print books for the first time in their history, we saw things in academia like Project Muse Editions and the University Press Ebook Consortium, UPEC, the terrible acronym, but important initiatives, and I think JSTOR was trying to get in the action, where I think we're going to see more and more of the academic market being shifted very quickly to ebooks, which have so many advantages in terms of distribution and marketing and use, of course, with some negatives as well. But I don't know. Did other people feel that this was the year that this kind of came into the mainstream and took over?
I'm going to jump in and say yes. And the Wall Street Journal had a story just in the last day or two about showing those lines crossing, actually. And for me, the telling piece of information in that was that the price of ebooks is going up, meaning that the publishers now, you know, for popular novels and things like that, so the publishers now believe that that's where the market is, and the demand is sufficient that they can raise the price. And so they gave an example of some, you know, best-selling novel by like somebody like Tom Clancy or someone like that, that's actually more expensive as an ebook than as a physical book.
Mm. Yeah, that's
by like $2, right. You know, like a $2 price point.
Right. Yeah, you know, I was just at the Coalition for Network Information meeting earlier this week, and I talked to some publishers about the rise of the ebook and what they're doing in there. And I think we had kicked around on this podcast this idea of a subscription to academic books. Like, why isn't, let's say, Harvard University Press providing, you know, all-you-can-eat ebooks for $99 a year? Or why are they pricing ebooks at, you know, $40 rather than $9.99? And, you know, what I heard was kind of interesting, that there's still a lot of problematic contractual arrangements, especially with authors, that, for instance, subscriptions are really hard to parse out for royalties, and that's what's holding them back. And so there's real problems with, at least for university presses, to moving to new business models and to new price points as well. They're just not used to price points that are considerably lower than what they've been in print. So I guess this is something to watch as well. Tom, why don't we move back to you and move into the negativity portion of the podcast with your jeer of 2011.
My jeer is actually comes from just the last couple of weeks, it's a story we talked about on the podcast. It's Georgia Tech's complete overreaction to a single student's invocation of the FERPA laws and the resulting taking down of their entire wiki network, campus-wide wiki network, with, you know, years and of work done by faculty and students on those wikis. It's sort of representative of the kind of risk aversion that campus IT and university administrations so often have when it comes to new technologies. And I thought signaled the how, you know, if the MLA's appointment of Kathleen to head the scholarly communication division signaled, you know, that institutions were coming along, I think this signaled that we still have a lot of convincing to do to get those institutions to come along with us on this digital journey.
Yeah, you know, we like to think things change in academia, but this risk aversion part of academia is really
Should we even be talking about this?
I believe that the digitalcampus.tv domain name is about to be blacklisted. No one will ever find our podcast again after SOPA Protect IP passes.
Well, that's okay, because we can just get a new domain name. No problem, Dan.
I think we need to start sort of like pirate radio. We can have pirate podcast.
I have already registered Digital Schmampus.
So
they'll never find us.
I'm investigating an abandoned oil rig off the coast of off the coast of Virginia for our studios.
Sounds great, Amanda. Your jeer of the year.
I hate to say it a little bit, but I'm going to go out.
Go on,
limb.
Come on.
No one's
listening.
I'm going to jeer. My jeer of the year is Haystacks Badges for Lifelong Learning competition. You know, every year, supported by the MacArthur Foundation, Haystack is a terrific organization. MacArthur is a terrific organization. Mozilla, who's a partner in this, is a terrific organization too. I like them all, and that's partly why I'm very disappointed by the description of this year's digital media and learning competition called Badges for Lifelong Learning. We've talked about this a little bit on previous podcasts. You know, in short, it's, you know, they're calling for people to develop credentialing systems that are linked together across the web. I was looking at some of these. For instance, people sort of suggest particular content domains or skill domains, and suggest ways and you know, specific badges for those domains. For instance, they're doing ones for veterans, how to help veterans get jobs, how to translate the skills that they learned in the military into jobs. Now, that is an admirable ideal. I've thought a little bit about what bothers me so much about this, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't just being knee-jerk about the term badge, which is a little bit intrinsically silly sounding for some reason. And I want to say some things that I'm not critical of for this competition. I'm not critical of the fact that it suggests that there are institutions and organizations other than universities that can provide credentials, because I think that's absolutely true, and that should be true and is already true. You know, if you're in, you know, a dental hygienist or something, you need to get continuing education credits, you know, and you post a little certificate on your wall. I mean, there are developers, there's all kinds of, you know, certification that you can get currently from various organizations to prove that you know how to administer a Unix system or whatever it is. So I'm all for lifelong learning. I'm all for credentials provided by other institutions. My main problem with it is actually the notion that this will motivate people to learn, because I think that's baked into it a little bit. I think there's sort of a real misunderstanding of what gamification is. The notion that if you have an emblem of what you've achieved, you know, a nice little, physical, not physical, but visible designed thing, that will motivate you in the same way that, you know, those, you know, things like that animate you or motivate you in video games. And I think also that it's addressing a problem that isn't there. I mean, we all have resumes and CVs, and we list skills on them. And people, you know, exaggerate a little on your resume. You know, most people do that. But in general, an employer is going to believe you if you say you have a particular skill. They don't look only at your credential from your university. So I don't see why we need a sort of an authentication system for people's credentials. Anyway, I could go on and on about it, but that's the nub of the matter of why the MacArthur Badges competition is my jeer of the year.
Yeah, very, very controversial. I suppose we'll have to see what the outcome is and what the projects that make these badges look like in the end. Okay, thanks, Amanda. Mills, your jeer of the year. I like saying this is...
The jeer of the year.
Rhyming things, yeah. Okay.
Not to be confused with the beer of the year. but that's because we're a family podcast.
Right.
Mine has to do with the Cisco Corporation killing the flip camera after buying it. I'm not sure why you buy something to kill it off, but I mean, I know they had better hopes for it or something, but this was just a nutty decision on my part, or on their part, in my view. And the reason is because... Okay, lots of people have video cameras in their smartphones, fine. But the Flip provided, if not better, video resolution, it was so convenient and so easy and didn't require you to have a smartphone, which an awful lot of people don't have. And it was so easy to use with students doing things like digital storytelling. And it was just a great device. It works so well in this environment that we work in. And so they just killed it. And, you know, and they're knockoffs now, and there will be replacements in the marketplace. But it just struck me as a bad choice. And so because so many students over the years have used the Flip for presentations that they're doing in class, for archiving, you know, oral histories or anything like that, and it's just gone. And so now, of course, it privileges those who have nice video cameras in their smartphones, which is a very small percentage of the population. I'm ticked.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've really nailed it this year on the podcast in terms of the end of single-use devices and how much, you know, what seems good in the consumer market with the consolidation of so many functions into the smartphone, which seems good to a lot of people. The you know, the fact that the iPhone 4S has a great 8-megapixel camera, so you don't have to carry around a separate camera. What looks really good from that market looks terrible from the education market because, first of all, they're very expensive. When you factor in the yearly cost of an iPhone 4S, you have to get a subscription and a data subscription and all those kinds of things. And alas, as I've found out too often with my iPhone 4, you know, the one drop and you've broken the glass on it. They're really not rugged enough for, you know, third graders or even college students to kind of muck around with if they want to experiment with videos. So they're gone. They'll be missed.
Yep. And just I learned just yesterday, because I was having problems with the Android phone that I have. I went in and to the Verizon store and they were able to fix it for me. And I said, just, you know, because my contract's nowhere near running its course for this round. And I said, just what would it cost me if I wanted to just go switch to an iPhone 4S? And she said, oh, well, you know, since you're still have 9 months left in your plan, you'd have to just pay the full cost of the phone. And I said, oh, what is that? Because I'd never asked. $649.99.
Right. Yes. So not priced for the educational market.
No.
Right. Okay. Good choice for the GEER. My GEER for 2011 is the Authors Guild. I'll have to edit. Thank you. I was going to edit in some sound effects right there of people with pitchforks. You know, the ironies here are just, you know, abound. Just in the last week, this past week, the very end of the year, they are trying once again to get class certification with the judge of the Google Book settlement, which means they want to represent me and you and you and you. Every single person who's written a book, they somehow believe that they represent, and that I think, I suppose, from a lawyer's angle, is the only thing they can do. They want to win the lawsuit. They have to get certified as the right class of people to be suing Google. But gosh, what a mess. And you know, two or three podcasts ago, we discussed really the low point for the Authors Guild, which was suing the University of Michigan and their partners for HathiTrust, which, you know, if ever there was a fair use for a large digital catalog of books, HathiTrust is it, storing millions of books for scholarly purposes, not lending it out to people outside those universities, being used for scholarship. I'm going to edit in some kind of patriotic music behind this rant here, but depressing, rather depressing. And as I wrote on the Atlantic website a couple months ago, you know, what's really ironic about this is Scott Turow, who's the president of the Authors Guild and writes legal thrillers, often writes about really idiotic moves by lawyers and the ironies behind them. And this seems like one of them. So cheers for the Authors Guild. May you go away.
Quietly. I'm really annoyed that James Shapiro, who's a really well-known Shakespearean scholar, is involved with this suit too, because I actually quite liked his book. And now that's just ruined.
Yeah. Well, we'll have a book burning after the podcast is over.
Okay. Today. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that sounds good. Okay. Well, this is, I believe, our fifth year doing our year in review. And we've also tended to do predictions for the next year. And as our audience often wants some accountability from our various rants and projections. We're going to look back this year at our predictions from last year, which I think we actually didn't say were predictions. I think we let ourselves off the hook in advance a little bit by calling them things to watch in 2011. But let's see how we did. Amanda, I'm going to start with you. Let's listen in on what you said a year ago about what you were going to look at for 2011.
My prediction for 2011 is that the Berkman Center's planning initiative for the National Public Library of America will continue to plan all through 2011.
You're planning on planning.
Oh, I'm so in agreement with that.
Yeah, I think that I think it's marvelous. Don't get me wrong, but it's a slightly snarky way of saying I don't think that much is going to come out of it in 2011.
Okay, so nice choice. The I think what you were calling the National Public Library of America, which became the DPLA, the Digital Public Library of America, continuing to plan. How do we think Amanda did here? I think you did pretty well, Amanda. I think you're getting 4 stars for that prediction.
Yeah, I think that's gonna be hard to beat.
I think you gave me too much credit because, of course, my tone was snarky, and
three out of four stars, right? I mean, there was planning, but actually, you know, by the end of the year, it seemed like things were rolling. The technical working group was going. There was this big meeting in Washington that we talked about. There was $5 million contributed by the Arcadia Fund and the Sloan Foundation. Things seem to be moving, but you're right.
The question is whether you can still make that same prediction this
year. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you willing to renew that prediction that nothing will exist in 2012 to actually look at, that'll just be planning?
No, actually. I have a sticker for the DPLA on my laptop. So what better sign of good things to come is there than that?
Yeah, a badge.
It must already exist.
A sticker is not a badge.
Okay, your crystal ball now has a badge for very accurate predictions for 2011. Mills, let's listen in on what you had to say a year ago this month.
My prediction for 2011 is that 7 university presses will close.
Oh, wow. Thank you for very specific. 7 university presses.
Okay,
will you enumerate them?
No, I do not have a list, but I predict that 7 will close. There are far too many in the marketplace as it is. All or almost all of them are losing money. Mm-hmm. The financial situation of colleges and universities has not improved in 2010 and is probably not going to improve in 2011. And most importantly, Rice University did not close down when Rice University Press closed in the fall of 2010. And so if I'm, you know, on the fiscal side of a university and I'm trying to figure out how we're going to make payroll for the rest of the year, one of the things that I'm looking at is the university press, because although they're not extraordinarily expensive, They're an auxiliary operation to the function of the university. It is not necessary for a university to have a press. And so why can't those other universities absorb the cost of doing this? And we're going to save money.
Okay, so focus on university presses going under. It was a good bet because in 2010, we had seen at least 4 by my count, I believe. Yes, university presses go under. Eastern Washington University Press, Southern Methodist, Rice, and their experiment in a kind of alternative digital press, and the University of Scranton all shut down. Well, before the podcast, we did a bunch of Googling, and the only thing I could find is Howard University Press closed its doors in 2011. Am I unaware, Mills, of your predictive powers? Were there others that I missed?
Alas, no.
Okay.
Good for them, bad for me.
Sorry, Mills. I think we'll give you 1.5 stars there for your predictive abilities, but don't despair, because you have a prediction coming up for 2012, and I think it was a good one.
As Yogi Berra said, I got my whole future ahead of me.
I like how so far we've made very negative predictions that have not come true.
Right.
I said nothing much would come out of the DPLA, and some stuff did come out of it.
Yeah, it tells you a little bit about our mental state on this podcast. Mm-hmm. We need positive Let's hopefully we'll have some positive predictions for 2012.
The sun will come out tomorrow. I can sing the rest of it if you want.
I think like the Academy Awards, we do need a song and dance number as part of this annual podcast. Okay, Tom, I believe you talked about a certain foundation from a Microsoft founder.
So I'm not sure it's a prediction, but it's definitely something I'm going to be watching in 2011. And that's the Gates Foundation and their investment of $20 million in educational technology, particularly technology for higher education. The Gates Foundation, in I guess it was October, maybe at the EDUCAUSE meeting, made an announcement that they are going to be through EDUCAUSE putting $20 million, perhaps $20 million a year for 4 years. So it may ultimately be an investment of $80 million into building systems for higher ed. That is so. That in itself is news, but I think in 2011, I want to see what comes of that. I'm interested to see what exactly they're going to fund, because, you know, $20 million in this space is a lot of money.
Okay, Gates Foundation and their impact on higher ed. Another, I think, wise prediction, given what had happened the year before. We did a little Googling on this, and we'll link to it from the show notes. It seems like they did quite a bit of awarding of grants in post-secondary education. There's a whole page of them on their website.
Yeah, they did do. Yes, there is a page on a website that has a list of grants. I don't think we've seen much, at least I haven't, and maybe I haven't been paying close enough attention, as I promised I would. I could renew that promise for this year and report
double down
in December 2012. But there has been a lot of activity. They've made two rounds of grants. I think they're moving towards a third round of grants. And I still do think that it takes a while for grant-funded projects to make an impact, but I do think that if they are making multiple rounds of grants per year, to the tune of several tens of millions of dollars, then those projects, we will start to see the fallout from them. One of the things I did notice is that a lot of what's being funded tends to fall into areas, the STEM areas, more than the humanities and social sciences. So that's actually something to consider as well.
Surprise.
Yeah, I mean, surprise. No, I mean, and not necessarily a bad thing at all. I don't think we've seen as much effect on the fields that we're all part of. But I still do think they're a major new player. We're going to see things coming out of these projects. And it will be, again, I think, something to watch in 2012.
Okay. We will watch it then. As usual, I think I was overly verbose and too clever by half in my prediction. Let's rewind the tape. So my prediction is a little bit off the wall for 2011, but I'm going to predict the rise of data-driven multilingualism. That's my prediction for 2011.
Can you say that again five times fast?
I was trying to think of the longest prediction I could come up with, and data-driven multilingualism was what I came up with. Just this morning, there was an app for the iPhone only. Sorry, Mills. Where you can wave your iPhone over a menu that's in Spanish, and it reads the letters in Spanish and the words in Spanish and translates it into English. And I know Google is doing a lot on this front too, but they've built up such incredible databases of word and phrase pairs in English Spanish, all kinds of from to pairs of languages, that I think we're going to see some pretty astonishing changes to the way we interact with people who do not speak our language in 2011. Okay, data-driven multilingualism. Gosh, what was I thinking? I think I'm going to give myself 2 stars here in that auto-translation did spread quite a bit, most recently to Google Books, where with their new annotation system, you can highlight a paragraph or sentence and a a little dialogue box will come up and allow you to translate it into any language you'd like. We certainly saw translation apps flourish, but on the negative side, the Google Translate API, their service that allowed a lot of these apps to work for free, was moved into a, I guess the free version of it is now gone, and you have to pay for these commercial Google Translate apps. They have to pay Google, and so now they're in trouble. And I suppose we didn't really see something like Siri do auto translation or some kind of Babelfish thing. I know there are apps like that for Android. Am I missing things where multilingualism and data-driven translation spread more than it did, or more than I can think of in 2011? Okay, I'll take that silence as a bad sign. I'm going to double down on this one. I don't know. I think we're going to see translation move to Siri in 2012.
I do think that there's this translation, machine translation, you know, handwriting recognition. These are always things that are like just over the horizon, I feel like.
Cold fusion.
Yeah, right. You know, they're just you know, always 5 years away or something.
Yeah, but the voice transcription stuff this year, you know, with things like Siri, which is really just dragons naturally speaking behind the scenes, that nuanced technology stuff, it's rather good. I mean, I've been using it a lot on my phone just as a separate app, and the quality of that really came of age in this year. So maybe something to keep an eye on. You're right that it does tend to be over the horizon, but I'm banking on it. I'm banking on it. Okay, well, speaking of banking on it, it is time for our final round and our predictions. Now, these are going to be more explicit predictions. They have to be predictions that can be either quantitatively or qualitatively assessed as being correct or incorrect, so we can cheer or jeer you this time in 2012. Tom, let's go to you. What's your prediction for 2012?
So I was tossing a few different things around, some smartphone predictions about WebOS and RIM and BlackBerry, but I think what I've settled down on is a prediction about Facebook. And I predict, and I think this is maybe an easy prediction if you've been looking at the curves anytime recently, but the growth curves. But I predict that Facebook will reach a billion users in 2012. But I think more interestingly than that, although Facebook will grow in 2012 to a billion users, I think it will lose credibility or at least cachet among students on campuses. I think with its growth, you will start to see, and we've said this many times, with its growth, as you know, mom and dad increasingly sign up for Facebook, I think that among the younger generation, they will start to lose interest. And I think that's coming for Facebook. And I think we're going to start to see the first signs of that in the next couple of months.
It's actually interesting, Tom. I saw a study just the other day about library websites and their presence on Facebook. A lot of organizations or events or whatever will create a Facebook page. And somebody did a study of that and said, are these at all useful in reaching people? And the study said, no, in fact, believe it or not, people do not want to Facebook their university library. You know, most of the interaction on these pages was, you know, from library staff or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just interesting because I don't think that Facebook so far has proven to be a really good platform for organizations. You can do like a brand page. I noticed some people have been doing that lately, like sort of converting themselves into like you know, my independent musician friends have, you know, stopped doing everything from their personal page and have created more of a brand page. But in general, Facebook isn't good for organizations, I think, and that may contribute to that stall that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I wonder also about this new timeline feature. You know, alas, I'm not on Facebook, so I can't play around with this. But you know, I think for college students to suddenly be faced with their entire history going back to their birth, something a little queasy about that. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I do know that, you know, the New York Times had a big article this week that we'll link to from the show notes on, you know, the scattered few college students who are just refusing to go on Facebook now. But, it will be interesting to see if that number grows. But I agree that I think at least it will flatten out. The growth will flatten out among that population. But maybe it's only because it's reached 95% of that population.
There's nowhere to grow.
Yeah. Okay, good prediction. Mills, what do you have on tap for 2012?
Well, first of all, I just want to salute those college students who are not going onto Facebook because they remind me of one of my great heroes from popular culture, which I'll date myself, but Blank Reg. Anybody remember Blank Reg?
I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll link to it in the show notes then, and you'll just have to look it up. Or Google it as soon as we finish recording. But and I'll just leave it there, and our listeners can go find who Blank Reg was. But mine is that I think the one to watch is going to be the Kindle Fire. And I'm on record as from the beginning as saying I thought the Kindle was a bad choice for higher education for a whole lot of reasons, not for people just reading books, but for teaching and learning applications, because it did not also have the kind of web connectivity that is important in the work that we do with technology these days. And so I'm going to be really interested to see what happens with the Kindle Fire in 2012, because I think it really does have the potential to do some really interesting things in the same way that the same way, but also some different ways from the iPad. So that's the one I want to keep an eye on. I might actually even buy one so I can play with it.
Okay. Well, that's a bold prediction because it's been getting kind of lousy reviews, or maybe that's just the press I'm reading, but, certainly, I think it's selling like hotcakes. So
I think the reviews are sort of the reviews are mixed, and I think it depends on who you are and what your expectation is.
Yeah.
If you're
an
iPad user and you pick up a Kindle, I think you're going to be disappointed because I don't think it does what the iPad does.
Right.
But I think if you want to read magazines and books and watch videos, then I think it's a nice size, it's snappy, it's got a good screen, and it's priced right. So I think the question is whether it's an iPad competitor.
Right.
I think that ends up being the real question. And I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Curious to see if it shows up on campuses in particular. Because the iPad is a very, very pricey item for a student.
Well, as we were talking about with the Flip, I mean, cost is such a key consideration for institutions that want to check these out or loan them or something for students, because you just can't do it unless, you can't do it with $700 things like the iPad or the iPhone, but you can do it with $200 things. So, I mean, the Kindle Fire as a tablet might be a really good option for institutions who want to experiment with tablet loaning. And the reviews that I've read say it has some major flaws, and it's the sort of initial version of the Amazon tablet. But for $200, it's great,
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And I'm sure there'll be a Fire 2 or whatever it will be, some new iteration of it in the new year. Amanda, prediction for 2012.
I predict that at least one university library will put buy this book links to either Amazon or Barnes & Noble on each record in its catalog. We didn't talk... I'm actually getting this. I need to sort of give credit for the ideas behind this to Eric Hellman,
mm-hmm.
who is...
Glue Jar, right?
Glue Jar, yeah. He's behind a project called Glue Jar, which is a really interesting model. His idea is that it's basically like crowdsourcing... licensing in a way. What he says, what Glue Jar will do, it's not really up and running yet, but will invite individuals and institutions to club together to pay rights holders to license their work, which is a great idea because, one institution can't necessarily pay someone enough, like all the money that they would want to license their work digitally. Because they're just so afraid of it. But if you get a lot of people together, maybe we can all drum up enough money. Anyway, he was writing about links, these buy links in library catalogs. One public library in Douglas County, Colorado, did it. You can argue for or against this kind of thing. But what's kind of interesting about it is you know, if libraries are in trouble now, particularly public libraries, this might be a way for them to get out of trouble. And similarly for universities, the British Library actually does this, the British Library Catalog. So the British Library is not a university library, and it's, I mean, it is a public library, but it's one of these very special, very large research public libraries. But the British Library in its catalog has links that let you go buy this item at amazon.co.uk. And this was kind of controversial in October, and they took them out for a while, and then they put them back in, and Amazon is actually paying them, you know, for this link. And I think it's a way for universities to raise revenue. You know, whether it's a good idea, we don't know. But if it happens, it will be interesting to see.
Okay. Interesting prediction. Yeah. You know, I think some people will be skittish about putting those links in, but maybe that's a new business model that we'll see in the new year.
Well, I think a university that did this would probably not be a Harvard or a Berkeley or Yale. It would be, you know, a community college or a third tier college. But as a revenue raising model, I think it's it exists. Barnes & Noble already has such a kind of a monopoly on a lot of student bookstores. I think they would be a logical partner for this. But Amazon is also really interested in this because Amazon, I am guessing that Amazon thinks that libraries might be a, you know, a gateway drug for books that, you know, people might get a book from the library and then decide they want to buy it. And I think that's why Amazon has been doing this program with a couple of people.
Right, right. Well, I know I find, you know, and I do a lot of my reading on my iPad. I often use Overdrive to get free ebooks from my public library in Fairfax County. And, but oftentimes they're not available. They're already checked out. And, you know, bizarrely for an ebook, you know, you can only have one circulation going at a time with a book that is actually virtual, but that's the way it works. And, you know, that has often led me to just buy the damn book. And if there was a link there and I could give a 10% cut to the local library, that'd be great. So, all right, we will look at that. Well, my prediction for 2012 is that these experiments that have occurred this fall with, particularly at Stanford, of massive online classes, most of them in computer science so far, but I think this will spread out. That's not my exact prediction. I do predict that these classes, some of which have had, I think, approaching 100,000 students following along online and actually doing the, you know, exams and the papers and everything like that, I think they're going to get commercialized in 2012. That I think it's going to move from the realm of an informal test, like at places like Stanford, into something that is more commercial. I think they're going to find a way to charge $10 a head and all of a sudden realize that they're making $1 million. So I think this is sort of inevitable, and I'm curious to see how this experiment goes once that's tried out. So it may not be Stanford, because I think they're still playing around with the reputation question, what it does to your brand. But I think there's going to be other superstar academics who will try out this model in some way. We'll have to see how that goes and what the impact is. There was an interesting article in the Chronicle that I'll link to from the show notes this week about how they think these massive online classes of tens of thousands of students are going to actually hurt the local community colleges, that Stanford will be fine. And the Stanford degree will still count for quite a bit, that piece of paper, but that it's going to hurt the smaller colleges. So that's what I'm watching. I predict it will go from informal to something much more formal and commercial in 2012.
And well, Dan, will you be teaching one of these, one of these 10,000 student classes?
I hope
in the
so.
Fall,
yeah. You can sign up now at dancohen.org/, you know, feed
You're
my
out of
kids.
/ pay me a dollar under the table.
Right. Yeah. Well, we will not charge for this podcast in 2012, but if you'd like to send us something, you can send us a nice note, feedback@digitalcampus.tv, stories you want to hear about in 2012. Be sure to comment on any episodes, stories that we may have missed in our year-end review, just by going to digitalcampus.tv. And we'll take a little break for the holidays, but I want to wish Mills and Amanda and Tom very happy holiday season to all of you and to all of our listeners to the podcast. One prediction that I can be sure about is that we will celebrate our fifth anniversary of this podcast in the early part of 2012, which will be great. Another giant gala ball, but for right now, this tux is getting uncomfortable. And so it must end our 2011 edition of the Year in Review and our predictions for 2012. We'll see y'all in the next year.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.